from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Tensions with Iran, ongoing hacking of the U.S. by Russia, China, and other foreign powers. Cyber threats are in the news, and what keeps national security expert Richard Clark up at night is concern over the U.S. getting ensnared in a cyber war.
We've had shots fired several times, including by the United States. We've lowered the barrier. It is easier to imagine cyber war initiating. And once it initiates, getting out of control.
A former national security officer in the Clinton and both Bush administrations, Richard Clark joins us to talk about the threat of cyber war and more. That's all next after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. While the U.S. has made significant progress in defending itself against foreign cyber attacks, it still remains vulnerable to a range of significant threats, including the takedown of power grids and election hacking. Former U.S. counterterrorism official Richard Clark, who was a national security officer in the Clinton and both Bush administrations, says he fears even worse scenarios await, like the U.S. getting pulled into war against a cyber army capable of hacking the country's conventional weapon systems. Just how prepared is the United States for cyber war? Richard Clark joins us to discuss that and his new book, The Fifth Domain, Defending Our Country, Our Companies, and Ourselves in the Age of Cyber Threats. We're also going to talk with him about ongoing tensions with Iran and today's settlement and the Equifax data breach, which affected 147 million U.S. consumers, and that includes 15 million Californians. And Richard Clark, pleased to have you back with us in Forum. Welcome to the program.
It's good to be back.
I guess the place I'd like to begin with you is just getting to one of the central questions that you're raising here, maybe the central question. And I should say for the benefit of listeners that when we talk about the fifth domain, we're talking about land, sea, air, and space as being the four domains. This is the what the Pentagon calls the fifth domain, cyberspace. And we just had Bulgaria that was hacked. I mean, when a whole country is hacked, you have to kind of really raise your eyebrows above your head and think, where are we? So that's where I want to begin with you. Where are we, particularly since you bring up the real potential threat of cyber war? How prepared are we?
Well, 10 years ago, Rob Kanaki, my co-author, and I wrote a book called Cyber War, in which we said, over the course of the next several years, hacking will stop being teenage boys in their mother's basement, and it'll become nation states and armies. And instead of just stealing money, we'll be stealing intellectual property, and we'll be doing destruction, damage, disruption. Unfortunately, we were right.
Unfortunately, Silicon Valley didn't listen to you, did they?
Well, not enough. But we were also wrong in some respects, because we said 10 years ago, no company will be able to defend itself against a major nation-state attacker. And that's not true. We were wrong. There are a lot of companies today. We call them in the book the dogs that did not bark. A lot of companies today that are successfully defending themselves, that are being resilient, using existing technology. And so we try in the book to say things are not all bad, and we try to ask, how is it that some companies are good at this? What do they do to get it right?
You mentioned the word resilience. This is a key word here. You're talking about a cyber resilience. You're also talking about a partnership between government and the private sector. But when you talk about resilience, you're really talking about more defense than attack?
Yeah. So when we say resilience, we're kind of lowering the bar a little. You know, in the old days, we said, don't let the bad guys in to your network. We now know that that's impossible. We don't have perimeters anymore on networks. We used to have big firewalls and everything was behind the firewall. Now you're taking your corporate, your company network with you on that company iPhone or on that company laptop that you may have at home. So there's no perimeter. And the bad guys will get in. But in the resilient company, they don't get very far. We talk in the book about something called the kill chain, which is the seven or eight steps an attacker has to go through to be successful. They only have to be stopped at one of those steps, and there's technology for each of them to find the attacker and to wall them off, to contain them, to prevent the attack from spreading. and then to restore services quickly. If you can do all of that in a matter of minutes, then you are a resilient company.
Well, you make the case that since we now have over 3,000 new technology firms with a lot of VC backing, you got cyber insurance, you got banks that are more secure, there's kind of optimism in your book.
There is. On the other hand, you know, I think if you stand on the street corner in San Francisco or Palo Alto and you say, I have an idea for a new cybersecurity company, five people will rush at you to give you money. The result of that is that there are way too many cybersecurity companies. At the annual RSA convention at the Moscone Center, there are 3,000 vendors all selling pretty much the same thing. It all involves machine learning and automatic defense and all the same jargon. Very hard for companies to find the good security products in that maze. And it also, it spreads the security talent out too thin. Bob Ackerman of Allegis Capital down on Embarcadero told us this is like the peanut butter being spread too thin. There aren't that many talented people, and if you put them in 3,000 companies, they're not going to be as productive as if there were a handful of companies providing all of these services.
Sorry, thinking about that peanut butter metaphor, wondering if it's smooth or chunky. We're talking to Richard
Clark.
It's chunky. Richard Clark, who is a security expert, former national security officer in the Clinton and both Bush administrations, and now has a book out with Robert Kanaki called The Fifth Domain, Defending Our Country, Our Companies, and Ourselves in the Age of Cyber Threats. Notice on the back of your book, Leon Panetta says cyberspace is the battlefield of the future, and I think that's probably correct, and that's a very central point of your book. You could also say the future is here already, as Andy Grove used to say, or as maybe Toffler used to say in Future Shock. With Russia, China, and Iran, we're here, aren't we?
Yeah, we are. Dan Coats is the director of national intelligence, and he testified before the Congress in open session in March, saying that we have to fear the Russian, Chinese, Iranian, and North Korean militaries in cyberspace because they're all active there. Cyber activity is going on every day. This month, the United States attacked Iran after they shot down one of our drones. The president did not respond with missiles or bombs. He responded with a cyber attack. Last October, prior to the election, the United States attacked the Russian troll and bot farm in St. Petersburg. The White House leaked recently that the United States has worked its way into the command system of the Russian electric power grid. So those are just the things we know of that the U.S. Is doing, and all of these nations are active every day.
And one thinks of Stuxnet with Iran, and now things are more tense perhaps than they have been in a long time with Iran. But also, as you point out, Russia, in effect, in many people's minds, declared war on us in the last election. It seems that all the intelligence agencies, despite President Trump's views to the contrary, were of one accord in believing that Russia compromised our election processes. And Russia also shot down Ukraine power grid, which was, from your judgment, likely maybe even a kind of rehearsal or presentation for an attack on the United States?
Well, they did it twice. On two occasions, the Russians went into the control system for the Ukrainian power grid and shut down the grid. And what we write in the book, The Fifth Domain, is according to the experts we talked to, given where they were in the controls, they could have caused the transmitters, generators to blow up. And if you lose that kind of hardware from a software attack, if you can cause hardware to blow up, it could be months before some of that stuff is replaced. We think that could happen here. According to U.S. intelligence, the Russians are in the control of our power grid. So at any time when we're butting heads with them somewhere, the president of the United States has to know if you go too far with them, suddenly New York or San Francisco might be without power.
Speaking about without power, let's talk about breaches, if we could, because there was a data breach, the Department of Veterans Affairs, back in 2006, and about 26 million veterans and military personnel were affected by that. Now we have the settlement that was made with Equifax, personal data of literally millions that was compromised there. And one has to ask the question of what is really being done in the broader sense about these breaches. I mean, they're still going on. The dark web is still there. And you say there may be six steps or eight, what did you say, a number of steps clearly that you can go through and you can defend against. But we still have all these huge breaches.
Well, Equifax, from what we know of it from public reporting, was sort of gross negligence by that company. And yeah, they're being hit with a fine, but they can afford it. Facebook was hit by a fine by the Federal Trade Commission recently for privacy data breaches, losses, and compromises, and that was a $5 billion is nothing to Facebook. Marriott was hit by the European Union with a $123 million fine for privacy violations. That's nothing to Marriott. I think these fines need to change. We need to fine the senior executives personally. We need to fine the board members personally. And we need to ban people from corporate practice. They should be banned from any publicly trading company for 5 years if they're a board member or a senior executive when an attack occurs and it can be blamed on negligence. Just finding them is not going to change anything.
So a bigger onus on the owners and on the operators, you're saying, essentially?
Yeah, if you can prove negligence. And there ought to be sort of an NTSB. You know, when there's an airplane crash, the National Transportation Safety Board jumps in and does forensics and tries to figure out who's accountable. Was it the jet engine? Was it the aircraft? Was it the radio system? Was it the whoever? We ought to have an NTSB that looks at major cyber breaches and names names, determines accountability, and then another organization that has significant power to fine people, individuals, and to get them out of the business. No one on the board of directors of Equifax is being punished for this. The Equifax profit will take a minor hit, as will, you know, Facebook and Marriott. Minor hits. Even their stocks typically aren't affected for more than a few days, and then they bounce back. So we have to make the loss of this data significant. What if we find people, we say in the book, what if we find people on the number of identities that were compromised? What if you got hit with a $10,000 fine for every one of those identities that were compromised? That's a much bigger fine.
What about the possibility, though, still, let's get back to the government's role in this. You talk more about, I mean, we're talking more about the breaches and what would be the consequences for companies being negligent and so forth. But the government has not exactly been on top of things here. And I think, aren't we in a situation, well, you pointed out in your book, where takeover of a power grid, let alone election hacking, all these things can happen, hacking our conventional weapon system can happen. And you run into the problem of finding out attribution. Who's responsible, as you intimated before?
Well, attribution used to be difficult, in large part because attackers pretend to be somebody else. You know the old joke, nobody on the internet can know you're a dog, right? We don't know sometimes without getting NSA's investigators involved or CIA's investigators who these people are. But attribution is possible, and the proof of that is on the Justice Department website. If you go to the Justice Department website, there are names of hackers who are Russian intelligence officers, Chinese People's Liberation Army officers, North Korean, Iranian. Not only their names, but their pictures. So I don't want to get into how we know their names or how we got their pictures, but clearly, if we have their names and we have their pictures, we can say this Chinese officer attacked this American company on this day, then I think we've solved the attribution problem for the most part.
Talking with Robert Clark, and he with Richard Clark, and he with Robert Kanaki is the author of The Fifth Domain, Defending Our Country, Our Companies, and Ourselves in the Age of Cyber Threats. He'll be appearing at the Commonwealth Club tomorrow here in San Francisco at 6:30 and at Kepler's Books in Menlo Park at 7:30 on Wednesday. And opportunity to speak with him and talk about cybersecurity. In fact, let me give out the number now and invite those of you listening to join us. We do welcome your involvement in the program and anything you have to say or ask. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. So please feel free to be part of the program. Again, the number to call, 866-733-6786. Or join us by emailing us, forum@kqed.org. Or, of course, you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. Or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, or Facebook page. If countries, Richard Clark, are regularly penetrating corporate networks without there being essentially notice, so to speak. Why can we believe that state electoral organizations with these tiny cybersecurity budgets and limited cybersecurity expertise could detect an attack that altered voter registration data?
Well, they can't. And that's why I was very upset when the various states came out after the 2016 election and said, "We weren't attacked by the Russians. We weren't penetrated by the Russians." That upset me because here are government officials who are supposed to inform the public saying something that they had no basis for saying. When a major American company is attacked by the best Russian hackers or the best Chinese hackers, it's really hard to tell. And I can assure you that the 50 states have not spent the money necessary to have the sophisticated, state-of-the-art, advanced cyber detection tools. They would not know if they had been attacked by Russia. I'll tell you a quick war story. When I got involved in this stuff in 1997, we made the Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines put intrusion detection systems on their networks. And a month later, we asked them, "How's it going?" And the head of the Army network said, "I hate these things. Before you put the intrusion detection systems on my network, I was never attacked. Now I'm attacked every day." I think that's the kind of the case with the election people. They don't know when they're being attacked. It's not their fault. They don't have the money to buy the equipment necessary, and they don't have the expertise. And the money for that is being held up in the United States Senate. Mitch McConnell, the leader of the Republicans in the Senate, is sitting on a bill. He won't let it come to the floor. It's passed the House. It has bipartisan support. But he won't let it come to the floor. He won't let those states and the 4,000 counties get the money they need to defend themselves in the next election against Russian interference. And I think you have to ask yourself, why? Why would he want to allow the Russians to do it again?
I have a sneaking suspicion you may have an answer to that question, especially since you worked in a couple of Republican administrations and know Senator McConnell.
I don't know Senator McConnell very well, and I would hate to question his motives, but it's certainly been suggested that there are some in the White House and in the Republican Party who rather like the fact that they got an assist the last time, an assist that may have carried them over the line from the Russians. Maybe they want that again.
Couldn't Congress, though, establish minimum cybersecurity standards for voting devices and for databases and, for that matter, for networks as well?
Sure. The Constitution says that the states will carry out the elections. And then it says, but the Congress may provide for rules. These are federal elections of the president, the president, the senators, the congressmen. The federal government can establish minimum essential security standards for federal elections. If Contra Costa County wants to elect its commissioner, you know, in an unsecure way, that's their right. I'm not picking on them. They're probably pretty good. But local elections is up to the local governments. But the federal elections, the national elections, we should have national standards. And if it costs money to get up to those standards, the federal government should pay for it.
And you're saying that this is not an engineering problem like getting us to the moon. This is something that really has to do more with like not inventing another internet or nothing like that. Most solutions, I think you're saying, are economic. They're tied to incentives.
they tied to incentives. And the proof of that is that there are companies that are succeeding every day at protecting their corporate networks. One of the things that Silicon Valley and the venture capital world have done over the last 10 years is to create new defensive technologies. No one of them will protect you. But if you string enough of them together, each one dealing with a separate kind of threat, and if you can integrate them all together systematically and have somebody who knows how to do that, you can achieve security. We saw this in the Russian attack on Ukraine. Some companies were destroyed, absolutely destroyed. All of the software wiped out on their networks. Container shipping companies stopped. No operations at over 75 ports around the world. Cancer drugs at a pharmaceutical company. Production stopped because there was no software to run the machines. Even Oreo cookies and Ritz crackers stopped being made because of this Russian attack. They weren't the target. They were collateral damage. But then there's a long list of companies that were hit by this collateral damage, and it bounced off because they were doing a good job. It's possible to secure yourself. That's the good news. The technology, at least as of right now, is there. Now, technology changes all the time. The threats change all the time. We've got 5G and the Internet of Things coming. We've got quantum computing coming. But right now, we think, and this is the good news in the book, we think you can secure yourself.
And do you believe that we are still ahead of the Russians and still ahead of the Chinese?
No. I think there's been a great leveling, both in the offense and in the defense. And there's not really a significant advantage anymore.
So we got to talk again for just a moment, if we could, about what you put forward here, not only in terms of resilience, but working to somehow balance or navigate corporations, the private sector, along with government, though you're talking about maybe more of a role for the private corporations?
I think the private corporations have to defend themselves. There's a notion out there which we attack in the book. The notion is corporations pay taxes. Well, some of them do anyway. Corporations pay taxes, and when those taxes go to the military, and the military should defend us from foreign military attacks. If a Russian bomber were coming over the Bay Bridge, it wouldn't be the responsibility of Apple to stop it. It would be the responsibility of the United States Air Force. If there's a Russian cyber attack from the Russian military, the U.S. military should stop that too. It's all very persuasive and logical, except it would never work. Nobody at Wells Fargo wants the U.S. government running around in the Wells Fargo network defending it against cyber attacks.
Again, we're talking.
And moreover,
Richard Clark, and I've got to go to break here, Richard, but we'll come back and hear more of what you have to say. And we'll also hear from our listeners. And I want to remind listeners that you can be part of this program and join us with any questions or comments by dialing in our toll-free number. It's 866-733-6786. Again, feel free to join us with your questions or comments at 866-733-6786. You can also be part of the program by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or get in touch with us on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum. And a reminder that Richard Clark will be speaking at the Commonwealth Club tomorrow evening at 6:30 in Kepler's Books in Menlo Park on Wednesday at 7:30. You're listening to Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Michael Krasny. Our guest this hour is Richard Clark, security expert and former National Security Officer in the Clinton and both Bush administrations, and co-author with Robert Kanaki of The Fifth Domain, Defending Our Country, Our Companies, and Ourselves in the Age of Cyber Threats. And if you'd like to join the program, we invite you to do that at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or by email, forum@kqed.org. You know, there's something else that I read that you brought up in an article you did that I read along with your book, and that was the lack of jobs in cybersecurity. There's a dearth of jobs that need to be filled. And so you were talking in this article about college education and how important it is not necessarily to go into fields related to computer science, but actually to go into cybersecurity.
Yeah. The federal government, working with the states, have created undergraduate programs and graduate programs in cybersecurity. You can go to Stanford or MIT. You can get an undergraduate degree in computer science and never once take a course in cybersecurity. There's no requirement in most places for a cybersecurity course. In fact, the only undergraduate program, I think, in the country that requires everybody in the college to take a cybersecurity course for a semester is Annapolis. So the government has stimulated this by offering scholarships to people who go into cybersecurity and full boat scholarships at approved universities. You have to pay them back by working for the government for every year that the government pays. So if the government pays for 2 years of your education, you have to go work for them for 2 years. It's a very good deal. But we're still short of the number of people we need to do cybersecurity. More now in the mid-level and the upper-level management jobs. The government has lost a lot of those people to the private sector. If you look at the big banks in New York, for example, all of their cybersecurity is being run by people who used to work in the government. Now they're being paid five times as much money as the government would pay them.
Yeah, I'm looking at a tweet from a listener who wants to know if you have any suggestions for cybersecurity students in regards to entering the field.
Yeah, so take a look at the Homeland Security Department and NSA together have created what they call Centers of Excellence in Education. And I believe it's up to like 80 colleges and universities right now, maybe more. Go to one of those because their curriculum matches what industry leaders as well as government leaders think you need to study. So the government-approved Centers of Academic Excellence in Cybersecurity.
And let me go to a caller. That's Wynn from Menlo Park. Good morning.
Morning. Thanks. When you left government service, excuse me, you gave what I thought was a frightening report on the capability of the government to meet the challenges of cyber attacks. Could you give us a report card of your opinion now as to how the government has responded, is responding today, and you expect them to respond in the next few years?
Well, not well. I mean, the private sector, frankly, has done a much better job in securing itself than the government has. And we say in the book, part of the problem is structural. The federal government tells every federal government agency, of which there are scores, that you have to defend yourself against the Russians or Chinese. There was a little HR office called the Office of Personnel Management that had all the security forms that everybody has to fill out, the results of all the security investigations. And there were over 2 million of us who had our files in this database. Now, if you're going to get top secret code word clearance, the government is going to investigate you. It's going to give you a real proctology exam. The government is going to end up knowing more about you than you know about yourself. All of that information was in the database run by this Office of Personnel Management. And the Chinese, of course, knocked it over in a few minutes, got in and copied all the information. And so all of the information about me is sitting in some database now in Beijing. What that tells us is that you can't have all these agencies trying to defend themselves. It's not within their capability. The Agriculture Department, the Education Department, the Interior Department, they can't be doing it. Give it to one department of IT security and let them give it as a utility, as a service to the other agencies of government.
This is perhaps too obviously a political question, but when we talk about leadership now from the executive, we're talking, of course, about the Trump administration. And I'm just wondering your thoughts, particularly in light of the fact that you talk about the hybrid war with the West that's been going on for years, as you call it, with Putin being nevertheless someone whom the president believes over our intelligence agencies in terms of getting involved in the last election through cyber means of one sort or another.
I ask myself, what would George Bush 41 or George Bush 43 or Bill Clinton or Barack Obama had done? You know, the presidents I worked for, Ronald Reagan, what would they have done if they were presented with evidence that the election had been hacked? They would have launched a major campaign led by a very senior official, a very powerful official with a lot of budget, out of the White House. A whole of government effort to make sure it never happened again. I don't see that. There are some good people in the Department of Homeland Security, some good people in the FBI and NSA who are trying to prevent it from happening again. But there's not much help coming from the White House.
And not much confidence that that's going to change, obviously, at this point, unfortunately. Let me read some comments. John writes, I recently read a very disturbing article by Julian Assange while he was staying in the Ecuadorian embassy in London. He seemed to have been deeply invested in penetrating our 2016 election process and quite involved with Russian entities to do so. Do you have an opinion, Mr. Clark, about Mr. Assange?
Well, I think the only question about this Julian Assange guy from WikiLeaks is, was he a paid Russian agent or was he just sort of ideologically aligned with Russia in their joint desire to hurt America? But he was clearly working hand in glove with Russia. The evidence is there. And if he ever gets to the United States, I hope he's tried for it.
Another listener writes, on Friday's forum, Washington Post and Wired magazine reporters said that worrying about face app vacuuming up our facial images was xenophobic and not a concern because the Russian CEO had assured them they were not doing that. What does Mr. Clark think about these assurances from a Russian CEO and about face app?
I wouldn't take the assurances of an American CEO, let alone a Russian CEO. You know, facial recognition has all sorts of problems. It can be a great benefit to us if we do it right. But there are no standards for companies applying it or government agencies applying it. And we need to have those standards. San Francisco has passed an ordinance saying that the police can't use it. So has Somerville, Massachusetts. But I think that's about it. I don't think any place else in the country has tried to create standards or rules about what you can do with facial recognition. We don't know how well it works. And there have been some cases where it didn't work well at all. I believe somebody ran the pictures of the United States Congress through a criminal database and came up with 23 matches of U.S. congressmen who were apparently actually criminals. They weren't, but the facial recognition software thought they were. So I would be very careful about giving facial recognition data to anybody. It's fine on the Apple iPhone because it never leaves the phone, but sending it to Moscow just doesn't seem like a good idea.
Richard Clark is our guest, security expert, former national security officer in the Clinton and both Bush administrations, and co-author of The Fifth Domain, Defending Our Country, Our Companies, and Ourselves in the Age of Cyber Threats. How concerned are you, Richard Clark, about the purge last spring at the Department of Homeland Security? I ask you that because Kirstjen Nielsen was, certainly recognized as someone who brought cybersecurity expertise to the job. Let me just read something from Wired magazine. It said, Nielsen's leadership on cybersecurity issues, for better or worse, stood out when the White House was cutting critical cybersecurity roles altogether, even as foreign hackers grew bolder.
I'm concerned about that. I'm also concerned about the firing by John Bolton, our national security advisor, of Rob Joyce, who was one of the nation's leading experts in cybersecurity and who was on the National Security Council staff coordinating the whole of government approach to cybersecurity, and he was dismissed. And the program at the State Department to negotiate international norms of behavior in cyberspace, that was demoted. I don't want to, again, ascribe motives to this, but there is a pattern across the government where experts, not just in cybersecurity, but in climate change and in other areas, experts are being driven out of the government. And even if Trump were to be thrown out of office in 2020, you can't get all those experts back. They represent in each individual 20, 30 years of experience. They can go take their expertise to the private sector and earn more money. They will not come back, and we will be for a generation trying to recreate the expertise in so many agencies that the Trump administration is driving out of office.
Well, again, what questions do you have about protecting your data? And if you work in the cybersecurity industry, we'd particularly like to hear from you. How prepared do you think we are on an individual, government, or business level? And Again, you can join us toll-free at 866-733-6786 or by email, forum@kqed.org. And let's talk about some examples, Richard Clark, that you talk about of corporations or individuals who are doing it right and doing it the way it should be done.
Well, the ones that we found, they don't want themselves named in the book. They don't want a big target put on their back. Because, you know, if you say, I'm cyber secure, that's just going to get every hacker in the world trying to prove that you're not. But the companies we found have three things in common. One is a governance system where the person in charge of cybersecurity, she's not buried down in the bureaucracy somewhere. She has direct access to the CEO when she needs it. She reports regularly to a board committee, and that corporate board has somebody on it who understands the issue. That kind of governance model leads to the second thing, which is a culture of security, where security permeates the company. There's education and training and awareness all the time. And it also leads to spending. The big differentiator between companies that can defend themselves and those that get hacked is how much money they spend. It just comes down to that. It is possible to defend yourself, but it costs more than some people are willing to spend. And if, frankly, if you're spending 3 or 4% of your IT budget trying to defend your network, you will be hacked.
Here's a listener named Garth who writes, the FCC has rules for preventing damage to the telephone network and to our broadcast networks. Do we need some new rules by the appropriate agency for manufacturers of network equipment to set a minimum acceptable standard of security?
We do. And the Federal Communications Commission has been adamant that it doesn't want to regulate the Internet. It doesn't want to regulate cyberspace. Some of the commissioners even claim they don't have the legal authority to do so. I think most lawyers say they do have the legal authority, but they could get it if they didn't have it. They could go to Congress and ask for it, and they do not. And so we're bringing in this new 5G network, for example, and there are not adequate security safeguards built into that. The Internet itself has a routing protocol that for years has been a problem that has allowed Russia and China occasionally to reroute traffic, Internet traffic, through Russia or through China. That's easily solved with a regulation. But as long as we have people in Washington who think that regulation is a four-letter word, then we're not going to be able to create the necessary security.
Here's Robert joining us. Robert, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. Excuse me. Thank you for allowing me to speak to someone who many of us have admired and listened to over the years. My question is, you stated that the Trump administration has diligently gone about removing individuals from positions such as the ones that you're discussing today. I'm in total agreement, but my question is, do you feel comfortable giving us either the reason for the Trump administration or Trump doing that, or if not, if you're not 100% sure, your speculation?
Well, I think the least awful explanation is they just don't think it's important. There were times when other administrations didn't think it was important either, and then they usually had their wake-up call. Trump seems to think cyber is important when he goes on the offense, as he did against Iran a couple of weeks ago. But he doesn't seem to realize that it requires an enormous effort to defend this country and to get public-private cooperation between corporations and the government to defend this country. So the charitable explanation is they just don't understand and they have other priorities. The less charitable explanation, could be that they don't mind if Russia gets involved in our election.
There's also the thought that unlike climate change, which President Trump once declared was a hoax made up by the Chinese, they don't have the concern because they don't really necessarily think it's that much of a threat.
Yeah, that's possible. I think the experts, the career people in government know it's a threat and work hard every day to deal with it. But is it on the top 10 list for some of the political appointees in the White House or in the cabinet? I doubt it.
Can you talk a little bit about a story that appeared in today's Washington Post? Chinese tech giant Huawei has been blacklisted as a national security threat, secretly allegedly helping the North Korean government build and maintain that country's commercial wireless network. How should the U.S. be dealing with Huawei?
Well, here's a case where the Trump administration may have it right. The Trump administration says there's a Chinese government law that any Chinese corporation must obey requests for assistance from the Chinese military or the Chinese intelligence service. And so even if Huawei were innocent and had no backdoors in any of its equipment, if the Chinese government came to Huawei, which is a Chinese company, and said, we want you now in your next software update to put a backdoor in the 5G system in the U.S., they could not resist. And it might be difficult to notice. So I think the president's probably right that we should keep Huawei outside of our networks, outside of the networks of our key allies. The problem is that there's not an American manufacturer. There's not an American alternative for parts of the 5G network that Huawei makes. And I think no matter where we get our 5G equipment, from Huawei or from Ericsson or Nokia, whoever it is, we need to have some third party certify not only that the equipment has no back doors in it when it's installed, but to monitor it on a continuous basis to make sure that no software update changes that.
Richard Clark is our guest, and his book, along with Robert Kanaki, is called The Fifth Domain. I'm looking at a tweet from a listener named William Richard Clark, who says, government cybersecurity is 10% security, 90% bureaucracy.
Well, any government project has a lot of bureaucracy in it. I don't know what he means by that. So I was a bureaucrat for 30 years. I think that's a proud thing to be because bureaucrats are people, particularly in cybersecurity, who could be out in the private sector earning much more money but have chosen to work in the government because they believe in the mission of protecting our country.
And here's a caller from Sacramento. Charles, you're on the air. Good morning.
Hey, Michael. So this is great. I'm looking forward to your talk with the Commonwealth Club there, Mr. Clark. And I'd like your expertise on three points. So take this down. One is the NIST developing standards for post-quantum encryption, if you had anything to say about that. And you're the first person that I've heard mention the fifth domain. Specifically, the Space Force, part of their directive and mission is to weaponize and defend the Earth's electromagnetic spectrum. I don't know what that means, but perhaps you can expand on that. And if you feel any vindication with Ms. Catherine Gunner of the UK regarding, weapons of mass destruction and the second Gulf War. Thank you.
A lot of big questions. I guess we start with NIST. Richard Clark.
Let me just take that one and save the other two for the Commonwealth Club. So the National Institute for Standards and Technology, we used to call it the Bureau of Weights and Measures. They are our technical experts in the government that bring together experts from throughout the country and throughout the world, not just government experts, but people in the private sector, and get them to agree on standards to approach things. With regard to encryption, NIST has always set a standard about how well something has to be encrypted. Now quantum computing is coming along. Coming along rather fast, I think. And some people believe that it could be used to break any code. From what I know, that's not true. That there are what we call quantum-resistant encryption algorithms. What NIST is trying to do, and they've set a goal of doing it by 2024, is to come up with a standard for what is a quantum computing resistant algorithm. I think that's a great idea. I just think 2024 may be too far out because there's work going on even in the Bay Area. The Rigetti company across the Bay is making big advances in quantum computing. And we may see an operational quantum computer able to achieve what's called quantum supremacy, being able to do something that no conventional computer has ever done before. We may see that even this year.
Since you mentioned the alacrity of quantum computing and how fast it's going, I'm wondering what you think of AI, and I've got a question, and there's a good deal of that in your book, but Sarah asks, what about the threat of combining new artificial intelligence-based software, the increasing prevalence of low or no security devices in the home, and the fact that virtually every chore of daily life is being handed over to some poorly secured internet-based service?
So we have a chapter in the book on quantum, a chapter on machine learning and AI, and a chapter on the Internet of Things. With regard to machine learning and AI, almost every cybersecurity product now is beginning to have some machine learning aspect to it. And that means it can respond much more quickly. The problem is that the attackers are also beginning to figure out how to use machine learning. And that means an attack could potentially take place much more rapidly. And that would challenge existing cybersecurity products. So as always with technology, there's a good news, bad news, because no matter what you invent, somebody finds out a malicious way to use it against you.
Good question from a listener named David before I go to more calls. David wants to know, well, he says, you mentioned that it's technically possible to harden obvious targets against cyber attacks. And as a tech worker, that's my intuition as well. But what about paying an employee whatever it takes to lose their security badge and take a day or two to report it? Security is only as strong as its weakest link. And in many cases, that means authorized users. Human beings are not increasing in sophistication at the same rate technology is.
Yeah, I think it's a very good point that the individual in a company has always been a vulnerability, whether they are intentionally trying to hurt the company or they just make a mistake. What we have to do is, yes, education, awareness, training to get people to be more sensitive to these risks. But we also have to admit that human beings are always going to make mistakes. Any of us, no matter how expert, can slip up and hit on the spear phishing email and then realize 1 second later, oh, my God, that was a mistake. So what we have to do is architect our networks, realizing that human beings are using them and making sure that even when a human being makes a mistake on a network, that the computer network is still resilient, that it can seal off that mistake and then repair it very quickly.
There are, however, at least from what we know, gangs of, call them pirates, brigands, thieves, whatever, hacking away and working in concert with one another out there. And you've got an article about a mobile network that essentially they believed information was being given by people who work for the network, who are getting low wages to begin with, and given over to these essentially gangs.
Yeah, and we also have increasing evidence that the Chinese intelligence is getting people to get jobs in American companies so that they can gain access to networks and allow the Chinese intelligence to slip in. So, again, we have to assume the worst and assume that there are bad people out there who want to hurt us, no matter what our company does. They may just want to steal our money. Even if we don't have any great intellectual property or R&D information. We have to assume the worst and we have to plan for it. And we cannot assume that there will not be a rogue employee because the history tells us there are in any company of any size, there will be a rogue employee.
And here's a caller who identifies as a caller. Welcome. You're on the air.
Hi. I work in the Bay Area here for a security consultancy for many years. And the issue of accountability is really where it's at, what I see across government, healthcare, or whatever. So given that the largest risks are within government agencies or any agency related to government, but your philosophy or your suggestion of personal accountability with CEOs or penalties doesn't really apply within that space. And I see this every single day. You know, you can pass the buck from an IT consultant, you know, engineer over to a marketing person or somebody who's approving a budget or delaying something. How do you systemically address passing the buck or delaying security implementations within government agency, which is the highest risk?
Well, I think there can be accountability in government. I talked about the hack by China of the Office of Personnel Management. The director of the Office of Personnel Management was fired when that happened. So that's pretty good accountability, firing the person at the top. I think in terms of contractors supporting the government, that there should be very heavy fines on contractors. Like, you know, Booz Allen Hamilton has had a problem repeatedly with people who work for it being spies, allegedly, I should add. Then fine them, ban them from federal contracting, take away their profits, throw out the directors on the board. There's all sorts of ways you can have accountability. If an agency doesn't achieve cybersecurity, then at the federal level, the Office of Management and Budget can come in and rewrite their budget and direct the money so that they will achieve cybersecurity and take it away from their pet rock programs. That's something that we tried to do in the Clinton administration, and it had some success.
You know, we've got seconds left here, Richard Clark, but we talked earlier about Iran, and we've got frigates in the Strait of Hormuz with British flags being taken over and drones flying. A listener wants to know, does Iran possess the cyber warfare ability to damage our electric power grid? What do you think?
Apparently it does, according to U.S. intelligence. The Iranians have attacked U.S. companies. They have wiped out software on companies. They're more sophisticated than we think.
Got to leave it there. Always a pleasure to have you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure.
That's Richard Clark, and his book, again, is called The Fifth Domain, and he'll appear at the Commonwealth Club tomorrow, Tuesday at 6:30, and at Menlo Park's Kepler's Books at 7:30 on Wednesday. Thank you for listening. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.